Conference is now being recorded.
Okay, and can you guys hear me now?
I can.
Okay. You're my only person there. You can go and relax, too. So you've got all your PowerPoints and everything?
Yes.
Okay, so you can kind of go and relax as well till one. Like, don't hang up, but, you know, that's good that you're there, and you won't be missing anything for the next few minutes, okay?
Hi.
Hey, Kim, it's Jean here.
Hi, Jean.
I have a question for you. Did you want me to, actually, I'm dialed in as a participant right now. Did you want me to redial in as a chair as well, just in case?
I think that's really helpful, and that's what the speakers are doing, so I think that always helps, Jean, just in case.
Okay, I will do so. I'll sign off then.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, who's that?
Hi, Kim, it's Celine.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, you?
Fine, thank you. Just kind of letting everybody sign in, so just get yourself settled. Make sure you've got your PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Kim?
Yes.
George McKibben here. Steve Malloy.
Can you hear me this time?
Well, we got a phone with a poor connection here, I think, and so I'm using my cell phone at the moment.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, is it possible to find another landline? Like, you actually are coming through pretty good, but do you want to see if you can find another landline? You don't need access to an email, I don't think. I think what I'll do is, to remind you guys when your time's up, I'm going to just play a little tune from my cell phone so you'll just hear it in the background. So I could
thank you.
When you've got 5 minutes left, and then I'll do it when your time's over.
We may have our problem fixed now.
Okay. Well, if you can find another line, that's great. And if you can't, well, right now your cell phone sounds pretty good.
Thank you. We'll try our best.
You've got Steve Malloy there as well?
We're both here in the city room.
Okay. And then, Steve, just a reminder to you that and to you and to George, just remember that we're not on a webinar, so you just have to remind people when you're changing pages, okay?
Thank you.
And any chance that I've got Tanya or others on the phone?
We're now on.
Kim?
Hello. Hi there.
Hi. This is Kim. If you're on the line and you've got your PowerPoints and you're all set, we'll get started in a few minutes. I'm just trying to check in to make sure we've got our four speakers on the phone. So I've got Catherine still. You're still there, Catherine?
I am.
Okay. And then Tanya, are you on the phone? Not yet. Sometimes it takes a few minutes with everybody to get through. So for those of you who are on the line, if there's anybody having problems with the getting at their PowerPoints, please just let me know.
Hi, Kim. It's Gail. Can you give me – I have George's and – but not the other two.
Okay. And are you on the website?
No.
Okay. And so do you need me to – you want me to email the,
sure.
the links?
Thank
and I'm
you.
Sorry, and it's Gail Bercy?
Yes, please. Thank
you. Hang on a second, Gail. Well, for those of you who are on the line, the first presentation will be Catherine Morency. So if you want to pull that PowerPoint presentation up, that will be the first presentation.
I seem to be having trouble with the link. I'm not sure why. I don't know if anybody else is having that same problem. Nothing's happening.
I had to click it a couple times, but it came up.
And I'm sorry, who was that speaking?
Helena.
Helena? And which link were you having troubles with? Or the link on
one.
The link on the invite?
No, the invite link works, but the one on the actual website.
So for Catherine Morency?
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? I think it is working, so it might just be that maybe there's too many people trying to download it at once, and it does take a little bit of time to download.
Okay.
So you might just try again in a minute or two. I will send the Dropbox to you directly, Helena, right now, mm-hmm. and you can try going in directly, okay, in case the other one doesn't work, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, folks. Hi, folks. This is Kim Parada. I just disconnected myself there. I think it's going to be one of those days. I'd like to get started in a minute or two. I just wanted to see if our fourth speaker, Tanya, are you on the phone? I'm sorry? Was that Tanya? Okay. Well, Tanya's one of our later speakers, so I think we'll get going anyway. Before we get going, can I just ask again, are people doing okay getting the PowerPoint off the website, or are people still having problems? Anybody having problems?
No, I'm good.
Okay. So what I'd just like to do is just, again, just to, so people know, I'm Kim Parada. I'm with the Heart and Stroke Foundation, and I, along with Jean Chin, we are the two people that run the Healthy Canada by Design CLASP initiative, and today we're doing a peer-to-peer session that was organized primarily for our members, but we've opened it to a number of guests from some of our partner agencies, and we have four speakers today. And what I will be doing, just a reminder to everybody that the session will be recorded and the recording will be put on the website. So if somebody couldn't make it today that you think would like to see it, they can actually listen to the recording. And I will be muting all of the lines when the speakers are speaking. But I want you to all know that you can each individually mute and unmute your line by using *4. So *4 will mute your line and will unmute it. So if at any point you're trying to speak and you're having problems, try hitting *4 to see if the reason you're not being heard is that maybe you've muted your phone. And just a reminder to everybody not to put the phones on hold. Jean has a horror story about that. And I think otherwise, we do have four speakers. There'll be a break between each one, so you can kind of download the next presentation. And we're going to start with the first one in just 1 minute. I just want to, I'm going to mute all the lines. So before I do that, and I'm going to just introduce Catherine as soon as I do mute the lines. So before I go, is there any other questions or concerns before I mute all of your lines?
Can you just repeat where we can have the PowerPoint, please?
The PowerPoints are on the Healthy Canada by Design website.
Mm-hmm.
And
what is the name of the PowerPoint that we have to?
And so, if you go into our website, it's hcbd-clasp.com. And if you go into the page, it's called Peer to Peer Presentations.
Mm-hmm.
all the four presentations are all there at the top of that page. And I will just say to people, I noticed myself when I was looking at some of the presentations that sometimes they come up with a black page. Don't panic. I found that sometimes if I just went to the next page and went back again, I think it's just because there's a lot of data on some of these pages. So if there's no other questions, the other thing I'll say to people is I do monitor my email. So if you're having any problems or difficulties, feel free to send me an email or one to Jean Chin. And I think with that, I'm going to mute everybody, okay? So just hang on a second here.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, so I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Catherine Morency. Catherine is a civil engineer and an associate professor at Polytechnique Montreal. She is the head of the Mobility Research Chair on the Implementation of Sustainability in Transportation. She conducts research on the modeling of individual travel behaviors, including the use of active and alternative modes of transportation. And we've asked her today to talk to us a little bit about the links between physical activity, active transportation, and public transit, and how they're all related. So, Catherine, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. So hopefully my line is not muted. And the other thing I hope it will be okay is that I hope the housekeeper won't knock on my door while I'm presenting because I'm in my hotel in Washington. So this said, I will start. So I'll try to remember to tell you which slide I'm on when I talk. And I know some of the slides will take a few minutes to load, not minutes, but seconds. So I'll try to be patient on this also. So actually today I decided to put more things in my PowerPoint that I probably will be able to discuss, but it will be available after. So that I think it was that's what I decided to do. I have two main topics that I would like to discuss. It's the measure we did with respect to the amount of steps that are involved in walking to transit, and this is an analysis we did using the Montreal data. And another study that I've just updated, which is the estimation of the potential of walking using the similar data in Montreal. So I'm going to slide two. And for those who like rapid the presentation, well, you've got it all in this slide, on slide two. So it's the outline. I'm going to talk rapidly about the objectives of these research, but we do other research on transportation and health. And the information system, which is the main data set that we use to do the analysis. And then I'm going to talk about the study we did on walking to transit and the estimation of steps, and finally about the potential of walking. So this other study where we look into the interaction between a mode of transportation and the incidence it can have on your level of physical activity, and some few notes on upcoming research that we're doing. So on slide three, there we go. It's the section on objectives and information system. So on slide five, the two main objectives of these research. So the first one was done in order to link the or to demonstrate was what was the impact of choosing transit as a mode of transportation on your amount of daily physical activity. And it's an easy thing to measure. Well, conceptually, we need some models to estimate the distance which are involved, but still it's something that people can easily understand, that they have to walk to take transit, and actually it can be a positive aspect of taking transit. And the other objective of this second set of research that we have done on the potential of walking is we were trying to assess how many steps could be done if instead of taking a motorized mode, people would switch to walking for short trips. So we did the first study in 2007, and then we updated this study looking at children, looking at the trends with respect to the distance that people are willing to walk or we observed or accept to walk. And then we developed this concept of steps in reserve, so the steps that could be outputted from the shift in mode. So on slide four, this is the description of the data set that we use. So in Montreal, we've been conducting household travel surveys since 1970. They are a very large scale, something like 4 to 5% of the population. Of course, the main purpose is not to assess health outputs, but mainly to observe travel behavior and the amount of usage of the infrastructure. But since the scale of the sample is so important, so we've got 350,000 observed trips in the 2008 survey, and the recent one has been conducted in the fall of 2013, well, we can do multiple applications of these data sets. So usually they're conducted in the fall period, which is not the best period in Montreal to assess walking, but still, it provides us a very large sample of observed behavior, and we'll get the data on household attributes, people attributes, and all the trips attributes. and you see in, at the bottom the scale of the region that we are examining. So if I go to slide 6, and this is definitely the slide that will give you issues, so you have to be patient, but if you click once, you'll see the animation of what is happening during a typical day in Montreal, and this is the slide that I always use to demonstrate the scale of the information that we get from these household travel surveys, and it's also useful to explain why we get congestion in an urban area. So actually, we see that all people are going. All right, so the density of people is increasing during the day, and then we've got the decrease at the end of the day. And it really shows the ability of this survey to follow people over space and time, and we get multiple information to look into the travel behavior, so mode choice, travel times, and all these things. So hopefully you managed to get this slide rolling. So the first elements were on slide 7. I start the section on walking to transit, and we had a paper published if you want more information on this analysis. So I move to slide 8. So the case study, in case of the measure of walking to transit, we decided to look only at the origin and destination points that were located on the Montreal Island, and this was really for data issues because we need a very precise local positioning of the bus stops in order to be able to assess the distance to access the transit networks. So that's why we use only the Montreal Island, because the network is more is available in a numerical format in a better way. And it's a quite important island, so we've got 1.71 million inhabitants. And actually, it gathers more than 80% of the transit trips in the region. So it's quite an interesting sample. So we've got more than 30,000 observed trips, and it represents, when we use the expansion of the survey, almost 1 million trips. Transit trips in the day. And actually, I should have mentioned that Montreal is quite a transit-oriented city. We've got an average share of something like 22% of the transit of the trips, which are done using transit. So it's a very good transit system, mainly on the Montreal Island. So if I move to slide 9, you see some statistics on the modal share. So you've got 15% of the trips. It's lower than what I said, but if you look into some specific corridors, for instance, in the trips going to CBD, you've got 60% of the trips which are done using transit. And between 2003 and 2008, the two survey years, we had an increase in the share of transit. So that's why we end up with almost 20%. So you see the use of the modes in terms of daily trips and also the number of people for whom transit or the other modes are part of the alternatives that are used. If I go to slide 10, this is what we define as a trip. So actually, a trip could be quite a fuzzy concept depending on who you talk to, but this is what we agree on in the transportation community. So we've got the origin point, and then using the survey, you've got some of the information which are declared by the participants, so the respondents to the survey. Then you've got some of the information that we need to derive using network-based information. So in the case of Montreal, we get the origin point. It's it's a precise XY coordinate. And then if it's a bus route, you get the bus the route number. If it's a subway or a rail, then you'll get the boarding station or the boarding, it's called a station in English also. So it's either for rail and subway, you'll get the station. So you're able to identify where happens the transfer point or where is the boarding point. So using the declared information, we recreate the total route, including access distance at the origin and destination. So if I move to slide 11, this is we had to use a simulator to estimate the distance, and we're interested in extracting the distance that will be traveled walking to access the transit network, but also at transfer points. So what we do is we look at each trip, so we've got plenty since we have a big sample, and then for both trip ends, so at the origin and destination, we derive a boarding or alighting station, depending if it's a bus or a subway, but subway we know the station. And then we use a calculation, a path calculation, to derive what is the distance that will be walked on the road, but we use a specific road network because we remove what is not available for pedestrian, for instance, freeways and ramps, and add some of the pedestrian paths that are observable or available in the data set. And in Montreal, we have an underground network, so we also use this kind of information in the network used to estimate distance. At bus transfers, we use Manhattan distance, so it's the sum of the difference between X position and Y position. I have an image on the next page. And at subway stations, it was a more complex issue because we don't have the representation in 3D of the station, so we have to make some hypotheses on the distance that would have to be traveled within the subway stations. So if I go to the slide number 12, this is the illustration of what we did to estimate the total distance required to go to the entrance stop on the transit network as well as a transfer point, depending on the type of node which are involved. So we did then after the steps estimation, so using the previous, so on slide 13, using the distance, we then convert this into steps. And we've been having quite some issues in identifying real nice data sets showing what is the average stride length. So we looked into the literature and found some various things that were used to estimate conversion ratio, so moving from distance to steps for various population segments. So we found in the literature that roughly we agree that there are some 2,000 steps to walk a mile, and then also that it's approximately 0.42 times a person's height. So we decided for this experience to use four different conversion ratio for the children, for the typical adults, and then for the elderly in order to convert the distance into steps. So you see the details on this slide. If I go to slide 14, these are the results that we obtained. So we represent the number of steps which are involved in the transit trip for various age groups using the previous hypothesis. So of course, for children, since the stride length is shorter, you have more steps involved in transit trips. But if you look at adults, more or less, you'll get 1,250 steps, which are involved in every transit trip. And you can see the amount which is related to access at the origin point, egress at the destination point, and the number of steps at transfer. If I go to slide 15, we've divided this, or we've estimated these results based on the mode sequence. So in Montreal, we've got bus, subway, and train. And so these are the upper results. So on the graph, you see the amount of steps involved in some of the transportation modes. So it's not surprising to see, for instance, that there are more steps involved in trips involving only train. And this is well known also in the accessibility literature that the attraction for a train station will be wider, and people are willing to walk more to get access to this mode. And there's also some fare integration issue in this concern, so people might not want to pay an additional amount of money to go to a destination which is within 1 kilometer, for instance. So you see the difference in the amount of steps involved. So you see some of the combination which would involve more steps. And if you go, for instance, on the bus only, well, usually you get the elderly people preferring to use bus. So we'll have a lower amount of steps because the bus service is nearer the destination and origin points. If I go to slide 16, we've also decided to try to use a simple regression model to try to validate the correlation between number of steps and some of the attributes that are involved in this amount of steps. So we use the age and gender, for instance, type of mode, so things we've observed in the descriptive analysis. Trip purpose, is the trip heading to CBD or not? And if you go to slide 17, you see the result of the model. So the first thing I have to say, and if you click on the PowerPoint, you'll see a bubble appear saying that, is that the overall model is not that, doesn't have that great performances. But it seems that it helps validate that some of these variables are correlated to the number of steps. So we don't have the right model for now or the right combination, or we're missing a lot of variables, but still we see that the amount of steps will be higher if you're a man, and it's confirmed by the model. You will have more steps if you use subway, if you use the train, if the purpose is for study, and all kinds of things like this. So this was the purpose of this simple model. If I go to slide 18, we did the scenario of modal shift. So actually the idea was to try to assess how many steps could be added to the individual daily travel if there was a shift in modes. So what we did is we decided to take all the short car trips and move them to walking, because that's one of the cutoff points that we typically use for walking, that people could walk 1 mile. And the second scenario was to see if we take 5% of the car trips and transfer them to transit, where transit is an option, then how many steps would it generate? And this is what you see on this slide. So there were more than 50,000 car trips that are targeted by this scenario, and we've got this walk-only scenario that would generate 250 steps during a typical day, and the walk-to-transit scenario, so shifting 5% of the car trips, that would result in 56 million additional steps. So it's big numbers. Of course, it's for all the population which is concerned. Slide 19, it's these results, but split it according to these combination for population segment and for the two scenarios, so the walk-to-transit and the walk-only scenario. So for each of these population segments, based on age, you see the number of steps per trip. This is the right y-axis, and from which, what is the distribution of the trips, with respect to type of purpose of the trip. So I know that time is flying rapidly, so I'll move to slide 20 and go quite fast with respect to this analysis, but since you have the material, you can go by yourself and look into what I will be talking about. So actually, it's just a short insight into the research we are conducting right now, and that we'll be updating with the new travel survey of 2013, and it's the assessment of the potential of walking in Montreal. And actually, we did, in slide 21, the objective was really to try to estimate the amount of physical activity that could result from shifting short motorized trips into walking. And actually, in this recent research, we've improved the methodology that was used to estimate this potential. So if I go to slide 22, what you see is the mochair versus trip length. So actually, on the x-axis, you've got the length of the trip, and you've got the modal share. So the first time I look at this kind of a figure, I was very sad on the first point of view, because I saw so many people taking a motorized mode for very short trips. And that gave the idea of estimating how many trips were lost, how many steps were lost. And at the first, it was called the steps in reserve, so steps that people could do if they were to switch mode. So on slide 23, what we did is we take the same travel survey, and instead of taking a fixed cutoff point, such as 1.8 kilometers or 1 mile, we decided to look into population segment and observed walk trips and fix a distance that 80% of these people, so the people belonging to a specific population segment, were walking. And we used this as a threshold. So instead of saying everybody can walk 1.6 kilometers, then we used this 80% of the trips, that the walk trips that some population segment do, and fix this at a threshold. So then it has, and this cutoff point is adapted to population segments based on gender and age. And then we look into the typical motorized trips and take the trips which are shorter than this threshold and suppose that they could be transferable to walking. And then we add additional criteria to identify if they would be transferable to walking, namely looking at the structure of the trip chain. So actually, all trips of a trip chain need to be transferable to say that one of these trips is transferable, because someone cannot walk and then have to do the rest in a car. And we also put a limit of number of a distance walk per day. And then we convert this distance to steps. So slide 24, you see the result with respect to the distance threshold. So using observed trips by these population segment, we're able to assess what 80% of the population of this group usually walks. So you see, for instance, these distances are in kilometers. So for the young children, it will be 700 meters, for instance. Then it goes up to the adults at 1.8 kilometers, and there are differences between men and women, and there are differences between over 5 years. So most of the distance has decreased. So the 80% of the walk trips have decreased in length during this five-year period. So that's what this table is about. If I go to slide 25, then this is the explanation of the chaining criteria. So how do we figure out which trip could be transferable to walking, taking into account the structure of the chain? If you go to slide 26, this is the evolution of the proportion of short motorized trips that are transferable to walking, not the short, but the motorized trip that could be walked according to these hypotheses. So actually, we amount to some 10% of the daily motorized trips that could be walked. And this is the purpose of the analysis, is to be able to estimate as part of the daily typical mobility how much of these motorized trips could be walked. Of course, there are various things that we need to do in order to make these potential trips actually be done by walking, because it's related to land use, to the way that the quality of the path that needs to be taken. But this is an assessment of probably the upper limit of what walking could be in our city. If I go to slide 27, these were the distance to step conversion, because then we identify the threshold distance, the number of motorized trips. But since we want to assess the impact on daily physical activity, we use distance to step conversion factors, and we did a more precise estimation using growth chart in order to assess the mean height of children, and then use differentiated conversion factors, allowing us to estimate the amount of steps. So this is the result from this. So the hypothesis with respect to the conversion factors. If I go to slide 28, this is the modes from which these transferable motorized trips come from. So actually, you see that for the kids, it's car passenger, and this is quite surprising because there are rules to access school buses also. We got 25%. So these 25% are below the distance is below the distance limit to access school bus. So it's quite a surprising result. And for the rest, it's for car passenger. And for all the other population segments, they're all done using car as drivers. And it's amount to 608 million steps per day. If I go to slide 29, is the distribution of people with steps in reserve. That's what SIR stands for. So you've got the amount of steps in reserve per day and the distribution, so the number of men and women who have these steps that they could do if they were to switch from motorized mode to walking for these trips that have been identified. And then if I go to slide 30, it's the proportion of the population who has these steps. So in average, it's more than 8% of the population that was under study that could make a switch for some of their trips. And you see again the amount of steps that it represents. So it's almost a quarter of the recommended number of steps to walk daily, according to health. Well, you know this more than I in the health domain. If I go to slide 31, what we're doing right now, we're updating the estimations using the 2013 survey. We need to improve the way we estimate distances using network-based distance instead of Manhattan for some of the elements. And we're also hoping to look into the time budget constraint instead of distance threshold, because one of the elements is that we need to have very good estimation of the current travel time, so using the motorized mode, transit, car, taking into account the congestion and cruising for parking. And this is something that is harder, but this is what we're working on in the transportation part in order to be able to assess the impact on increased travel time if you decide to switch mode. So that was approximately what I wanted to talk about. If you go to slide 33, you see some of the reference that have been used to produce this presentation, and page 34 is some our coordinates. So that would be it.
Catherine, thank you very much. That was an awful lot of information to take in a brief period of time. I'm just going to unmute the lines so that people can ask you questions. So just hang on a second here.
Yes.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay. So do people have questions for Catherine?
Is David Mowat here? Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Oh, thanks very much for that. It was most interesting, and I think you probably derive very accurate estimates. And I'm just trying to relate that to what's in the literature. And elsewhere in the literature, they use self-reported time spent walking. And I wondered if you, and it typically varies, you know, 15 to 20 minutes on an average work day. I wondered if you have any idea how your steps measure converts into time spent walking.
Yeah, actually, what needs to be said regarding the household travel survey is that we only gather trips that are going somewhere. In this, I mean that we will not have the information if someone goes out and takes a walk. So it's the walk trip that will end up somewhere to perform an activity. This is the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing is that we only derive time of departure. We don't only have time of departure. So actually the estimate of time, for instance, for the walking to transit, it's approximately 20 minutes. So it's in our first estimate, because it takes 10 minutes to walk 1 kilometer, and you've got the, I don't remember the distance, I should, let me go back. But we had discussion with the people from the health department in Montreal, and it's really fitted when we take some estimates of mean speed of walking, and it was almost around 20 minutes of walking. But it's really hard to get time estimates. That's why it's what we're trying to develop, because we don't have this information declared.
Hi, can I just interrupt to say to everybody, I've unmuted the phone so we can hear all of you. So if you could just be very careful about background noise when people are asking questions and Catherine's answering. David, did that answer your question, or did you want to follow up on that at all?
Yeah, is it 20 minutes that I'm thinking of a person going to work and coming home again?
Yes.
So is that 20 minutes times 2 or 20 minutes times 4?
Actually, if using the first estimate we did, we took a 1.6 kilometer cutoff point. So then the time was really related to the distance we selected and the mean walking speed, because we have neither of those. So I don't have estimates of time. I just have the distribution of walking distance estimated using, you know, a path calculation on the network we have. So it's really hard to, I could, using two or three activities, I can derive a time. That's
okay.
What we're trying to refine.
Thanks.
But if you look at the threshold distance, this is what 80% of a particular segment walks. Then if the threshold distance, for instance, for adult is 1.8 kilometers, this is for one trip, so to go somewhere. And then so you'd have to multiply it by 2 to do the round trip. It's something like 1.8 kilometers, so I would say it's 18 minutes. So it's around 20 minutes. 20 minutes.
Okay.
Catherine, we have a question was received by email. Someone has asked if you would go to slide 22, and if you could just provide a little bit of explanation about what some of the acronyms stand for.
Yes, of course. I totally forgot. CD is car driver, CP is car passenger, so what is gray, all that is gray is motorized. TR is transit, and SB is school bus. So WC would stand for walk and cycle.
Okay.
That's why it's red. I don't know why it's red, but...
Okay, and any follow-up questions to that?
I have another question. Can I ask it now?
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is Olivier Bellefleur from the NCCHPP. I was wondering about the four-time threshold distance, if you can explain a bit on this, because it seems to me a bit high. If you do 4 times 1.8 kilometers, it's quite a lot.
Yeah, actually, this was an arbitrary short choice for now. And actually, when we presented our paper, this was one of the questions. And we decided to use a criteria for maximum distance because there was none before, and we had to do a limit first and to be able to assess a better choice in this 4 or 3 or 2.8 or something else, we need to assess time because the literature we found was on additional time. And actually, it's if we did some calculation to see to how many minutes, additional minutes it would account, because usually in the literature we find that for the time budget constraint, it's between 30 and 1 hour additional time that people would accept because you've got other benefits. And when we do the estimation using the typical threshold for an adult, using a mean walking distance and congested the speed per car, it's around 1 hour of additional time if you use four times the threshold. So, but we're not able currently to say we have to use 3.5. We don't have the information with respect to time, and all the literature we found on this was on additional time.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting.
Hi, this is Larry Frank. I just wanted to ask a quick question if now is an okay time.
Go for it.
Hi, so interesting information. There are there is GPS using global positioning system where we've developed and others have actual objective data around time spent walking that might really help inform some of the information that you're trying to develop here. In particular, age specific rates at which people move, speed.
Yeah.
So that actually is how we do it. So that we actually have a better sense of the numbers that we end up with are reasonable. And then there's a lot of complexity when it comes to how much people would be willing to spend time on a different activity depending on their travel time budget that they're currently spending in other modes. And it's sort of well documented historically that we spend between 60 and 90 minutes a day roughly moving around. So if people are heavily invested in other modes, there's a lot of complexity to this. And if they're willing to actually, if you can get a trade-off, and no one's really proven substitution, but if you can have a modal substitution happen between driving and transit, then you have a cross-elasticity effectively. It shifts the whole game. So when I hear kind of the rough numbers and stuff, I think that there's a lot that could be done to look at the overall travel time budget.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, I have other research on the modal choice. Sorry, my phone is ringing. I have no clue how to close it. We're doing other research on the mode transfer model. So how do we estimate the shift from mode to mode and the mode choice model? And actually, the elasticity is something we're looking into. But first, we need good estimates of travel time using congestion. And I have another project on congestion using GPS points on the network. And we need to be able to estimate the travel time using congestion time for cars, or we will always decide that the cost is too high.
There's good methods to apply to that using congested speeds on the road network. And that sounds really, really interesting. But as you know, in the transportation literature, there's decades of work on mode choice and looking at how we are likely to trade between certain modes and not others. So you have to nest the relative utilities and shift. Yep.
Yes, but actually for using these new technology, it's changing the value of time. There's a bunch of session. I'm at TRB right now. There's a bunch of session on these the value of time when you travel, because you can, if you're in a comfortable mode now, you can value your time. So a lot of things are changing, and there's a lot of innovation in the mode choice modeling sessions. But also we need good estimates of time, and this is usually it's output from regional models. But with the availability of GPS points, then you need to take into account the variability on the networks, and it's region-specific data that we need for this. But not for walking speed. It's quite interesting. This is annoying.
I'm going to stop the discussion here just because we have to move on, but I want to thank Catherine very much for joining us. I know that you were doing it from a hotel room in Washington.
Yes.
So thank you for joining us today, and feel free to stay on the phone if you can, but I believe you actually have somewhere you have to be. So
yes, I have a poster at 2, so I'll stick around for a few minutes,
okay,
Depending on the time, and then I'll have to leave.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine. It was very
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to mute the phones again so I can introduce our next two speakers. And just so you know, the two presentations that we'll be looking at next are the one by Steve Malloy and by George McGibbon, and they're on the pedestrian mobility plan that was developed by the City of Hamilton. So those are the two presentations you'll want to be opening. And so I'm going to mute the phone now, and I will provide an introduction for the two of them, and then George and Steve, I'll hand it off to you, okay? Hang on a second.
The conference is now in silent mode.
So while all of you are getting your PowerPoints up on your computers, I would just like to provide a bio for Steve Malloy. He is a project manager with the City of Hamilton. He's in the Transportation Planning section of the Public Works Department. Prior to joining the city, Steve worked as a private transportation planning consultant and has over 13 years of experience in transportation planning and active transportation. As the city's project manager for the pedestrian mobility plan, he guided the consultant's work and collaborated with city staff to develop critical policy updates in order to obtain unanimous support by council to approve this plan. In addition to recent planning awards received for the efforts of the pedestrian mobility plan, the City of Hamilton was awarded a silver designation from the inaugural Ontario Walk Friendly Communities Program. And so that is who Steve is. And then in terms of George McGibbon, George is an environmental planner with McGibbon Wakefield Incorporated in the City of Hamilton and an adjunct professor in the School of Environmental Design and Rural Development at the Ontario Agricultural College of the University of Guelph. He is a registered professional planner and a member of the Canadian Institute of Planners and the American Institute of Certified Planners, in which he has obtained accreditation as a certified environmental planner. He serves as a member at large on the Canadian Institute of Planners Healthy Communities Committee, which is part of Healthy Canada by Design. He was also a member of the consulting team that drafted the Hamilton Pedestrian Mobility Plan. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to both you, George, and to Steve. Or not. George and Steve, are you there? No, you're not. Hang on a second.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Hi, this is Kim again. George and Steve, are you there?
Can you hear us?
I can hear you now. So did you dial in on the host password?
Yes, I did, on your host.
Okay, and but I couldn't hear you. I take it nobody else could? Okay. So you know what? Should we try doing it on an open framework? But we're just going to have to ask everybody to be very quiet to prevent background noise. So why don't you guys, let's try it this way, and we'll see if it works, because I couldn't hear you before, okay?
Thank you very much, Kim. On behalf of the City of Hamilton and the consulting team that helped put together this pedestrian mobility plan, and Steve Malloy and myself, thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation. I'd like to first start by describing the City of Hamilton. It's located in the province of Ontario at the head of Lake Ontario, and in terms of pedestrian environments, involves everything from heavy industrial areas to the central business district, right through to suburbia, to smaller cities in the immediate area, Ancaster, Stony Creek, Waterdown, through to hamlets like Carlisle, Freelton, and rural areas, and very natural environments as well, such as Beverly Swamp, the Niagara Escarpment, and Coots Paradise. On slide number two, we describe what the basic setting for the work that we undertook. And the problem that we face is one of creating safe, interesting pedestrian environments within an environmental setting that involves how the city does business, how it makes decisions, and drawing on evidence-based research in a number of different categories, such as chronic diseases, physical inactivity, obesity, collision analyses, greenhouse gas emissions, energy conservation, and air quality. And in effect, what we're trying to do is take into account unintended consequences of 50 or 60 years of focusing on transportation planning towards vehicular traffic movement. In a sense, research comes out of the consideration of unintended consequences. On slide number 3, I've listed 3 points that we've tried to take into account when thinking of good design and good behavior. And first of all, Daniel Kahneman is the author of a book entitled Thinking Fast and Slow. He's also a psychologist who received a Nobel Prize recently for economic decision making. And he makes the observation that when it comes to rare probabilities, read externalities, our minds are not well designed to get things right. And in order to achieve that fitness between right thinking and action, he suggests that we need to be very explicit when addressing unintended consequences in our analyses. Molyneux and Schaffer, in a book called Scarcity, build on this notion by suggesting that infrastructure managers are really pressured when they make decisions and when planning and delivering infrastructure services, and that pressure results in a sort of tunneling, which sort of puts at the side, if you like, the unintended consequences that we're trying to deal with. And the authors suggest that in order to address that problem, we need to take time out from time to time just simply to reflect and address on these unintended consequences more straightforwardly. And lastly, Daniel Goleman, in a book called Focus, and more recently and in the past in a book entitled Ecological Intelligence, suggests that we need to be measure progress through monitoring and some of the walkability analyses that are available in order to make sure that the decisions that we make are having the intended consequences of addressing some of the unintended consequences. On slide number 4, here are 6 things that the public told us as we prepared this pedestrian mobility plan. The first thing they said is that they sought comfortable, safe street crossings or intersection crossings, particularly on arterials that run through residential neighborhoods. And that was a common comment right from the central business district right through to suburbia. Secondly, they sought things like shade trees along streets, which not only have the effect of calming traffic, but address the comfort of the pedestrian environment through which they're walking. Thirdly, they talked about comfortable, safe sidewalks, not so much safety, but with sufficient passageway to allow pedestrians, especially when there's a number of pedestrians on a heavily traveled street, to pass quickly and effortlessly with furniture and the like along the side, and a very unobstructed passageway, if you like. Continuous network of sidewalks. Fifth, public transit system links, such as what were discussed in the previous presentation. And also, lastly, links to parks and open spaces. In slide number 5, attention to detail is essential if we're to plan for the pedestrian environment. And that detail varies depending on where one finds oneself within the city. We developed an urban transit to characterize and map the different pedestrian environments throughout the city in terms of the dimension of the street, the lake, and the built environment that runs onto the street. So on the right-hand side, we have the industrial area that's associated with the harbor. We have the second column from the right, the downtown. The third, the urban core, the urban general area, and suburbia, right through to natural areas. And some of the American research suggests that in terms of the downtown through suburbia core, you can actually characterize a physical activity by those built environments itself. And the purpose of this analysis and mapping is to identify the opportunities and constraints that are available to the city as it begins to implement the pedestrian mobility plan itself. On slide 6, historically, the city of Hamilton prepared its first master plan in the late 40s. And one of the recommendations in that master plan was that the street railway system that had existed and served pedestrians throughout the city in the previous 50 years be removed from the streets in order to facilitate vehicular traffic. In the 50s and the 60s, we saw several more improvements to facilitate automobiles and trucks. In the 60s, a very innovative study was undertaken by Parsons Brinckerhoff and a local engineering firm, C.C. Parker, and that used computer modeling to assess and make plans for vehicular traffic throughout the whole city, and many of the infrastructure projects that were recommended in that plan are projects that were recommended or built, in fact, in the last 30 years. So we're faced with the dilemma that over the past 60 years, we're dealing with a transportation planning system that has focused primarily on vehicular traffic. So the paradigm that we're looking at is that in that system, geometric design of the street begins with the center line and works out to the periphery, so that the leftover space is the space that's left for cyclists and pedestrians. On slide number 7, we describe what that paradigm shift entails, and it entails redesigning, if you like, or rebalancing at the planning and delivery system to begin with the starts of the requirements of the pedestrian and the cyclist first, and then work to the center line and accommodate the recommended improvements through routine accommodation. Let's move to slide number 8. Sometimes as a consultant, when we're doing a job, our clients give us favors, gifts if you like, that are really very important to our work. And in this instance, what the city did was it described by categories all the different decisions that might have to be made for any given transportation project that might affect pedestrian movement. So this diagram identifies the city decisions that fashion the streetscape, and our challenge was to identify what decision-making, what aspects of that chart had to change and how in order to facilitate a friendlier and safer pedestrian environment. And after we had done that, what we did was we organized the actual plan itself around each of these subject headings: operational, asset management, planning considerations, legislative, and communications. Let's move on to slide number 9, on which the routine accommodation decision-making process is described. Whenever any project is undertaken that involves ripping up the street and reconstructing it, this process is intended to apply. And in the site inventory, we suggest that a complete streets checklist, which was used in the City of Seattle and which we've adapted for the city, be applied in order to identify the baseline conditions. And also, we refer to the context area mapping that I described earlier so that we can understand the opportunities and constraints that exist with respect to the dimensions of the street and the land use pattern that abuts on it. In the review, in terms of the departments, we make allowance for bringing into the decision-making process any of the departments and staff that were involved in that previous chart so that all the relevant players are at the table when decisions get made as to how improvements are to be made. And in special situations, there may be reason to bring in the general public as well, and so allowance is made on the right-hand side of the flow chart for a pedestrian mobility advisory committee. In the evaluation, we've included within the report a series of checklists which prompt decision makers to consider various aspects associated with what we call the 5 E's, that is engineering, equity, encouragement, education, and enforcement, and that's to bring into play all the different aspects that are required, not just simply from the built environment, but also from the perspective of policy and program in order to implement the final design. We also have a box down in the lower left-hand corner entitled Evaluate Countermeasures. I'll talk about that in the next slide, but before I get there, I want to say that it's important to link the physical design that is being implemented also with policies, education, encouragement, and enforcement policies that may be required to support the design innovation that is being applied. And finally, there's implementation and monitoring. In the next slide, slide 10, we have a series of potential toolbox solution examples which are set out. And by toolbox, what we mean is a menu of solutions that can be applied in any given situation, depending on the street and the circumstances. And these are categorized in three different areas. First of all, there's walking along the street, and that's oriented towards the pedestrian comfort and the like. Crossing the street, which gets back to the issue of crossing major arterials and the like. And then also design measures that are intended to facilitate public transit, because every transit trip involves a trip to the bus stop or train station and a pedestrian trip away from that. These design solutions are, we used one of our partners in this effort, Tool Design Group of Seattle. The city pooled some of its research money with research that Tool Design Group was undertaking in San Antonio, Texas, so that we could put together a fairly complete menu, if you like, with the to the specifications that engineers and other design professionals need in order to apply this practically in work in the city. That concludes my part of the presentation. So, Steve, would you like to pick it up from here?
Thanks, George. Really, my presentation is on the George kind of set up the politicians for me, and this is where I try to knock them down when I did my presentation at council. So this is kind of a modified version of it. If you want to skip to slide three, I wanted to start off the principle that for simple understanding of why we were doing a pedestrian mobility plan and why the need to approve it. And the underlying principle for us was really, regardless of the primary mode of travel, every trip is it's a walking trip. So getting that understanding, it doesn't matter if you're taking a bus or biking or a car, you're a pedestrian at some point. And really the second underlying principle was really focusing on improving the overall quality of the pedestrian environment, because certainly throughout the public consultation process, it was identified that the willingness of people to walk was really linked to the quality of that experience and what we were providing. Slide four, again, that those principles of we are all pedestrians, the considerations for public health, we know that there's rising rates of obesity and overweight rates in our community, and I'm sure it's similar in other communities as well. We have an equity piece of a lot of low-income persons living in the city and the need to provide them with transportation choices. Certainly disabilities and really the wide-ranging definition of disabilities, not just the physical but also learning disabilities, cognitive disabilities, so that trying to be comprehensive in that aspect, as well as being age-friendly and using the 8 to 80 philosophies and recognizing that our community is aging as well as some other municipalities. So within that context, that's sort of why we're moving forward with the plan. But in addition to everything else, if you flip to slide five, we wanted to show that there's a good news story and that the city of Hamilton is doing some good current initiatives. We have a quick wins program through our Metrolink funding to enhance some transit stops, which is obviously a trip end facility for or trip begin facility for some pedestrians getting to transit. We have two current programs on slide six. We have a sidewalk extensions program that which we fund $600,000 annually in the capital budget, as well as a road urbanization program. And as part of that urbanization, we include sidewalks, curb and gutter. And so we have in our next capital budget, we have $1.7 million allocated to that, plus development charges and federal grant money to do some upgrades to roads. So that's that. Historically, we have not been providing, on next slide, slide seven. Historically, we had not provided the ladder crosswalks, but certainly over the last year, we've installed over 40 locations. We're monitoring those currently to see, certainly they have a visual presence, but whether they have any safety impact, we're monitoring that to make sure that what we're providing also is positive guidance for pedestrians and motorists and provide that safety factor. Next slide, slide eight. A neighborhood in the city, we've introduced a 30-kilometer speed limit, and certainly I'm sure everyone has read the literature, the lower the speeds, the impact of being hospitalized of a collision. This is a 5-year project in this community, and many other communities in our city are looking forward to those results and wanting to have more widespread adoption of that. And certainly is within our toolbox of speed management and reduced speed limits within the pedestrian mobility plan. In slide nine, another current strategic initiative that the city has is we have a free street tree program, and on average we plant about 6,000 trees. On the next slide is, that good news story of we are part of a pilot for Walk Friendly Ontario awards, and we were lucky to get a silver designation as part of the inaugural award submission. Silver is good. It certainly shows that we're not great. We certainly have room for improvement, but it also shows a good news story that we are doing some good things, and that's always a good message to show the city that we want to strive to do better, but also at times to give ourselves a pat on the back and we're doing some good work. We just need to do it more often and consistently. Keeping on that theme, slide 11, we're trying to be more innovative and using temporary measures. Not the most prettiest site that you'll see, but certainly it, when you have cost restrictions sometimes to do these full measures, we want to test these things out, see if they're successful before we go full board and spend our capital money on doing some of these pedestrianizations of some intersections. But certainly these are quick, cheap measures that are visible and certainly has had a positive impact in our community that we've seen so far. And this is getting into more of the measures that we've identified as part of the toolbox in the pedestrian mobility plan. That these aren't new items that we're seeing. There's a few new items, but there's some things that we're already doing, and we want to do these things again more often and on a more consistent and transparent basis. For example, like many other municipalities, no right turn on reds, that has a significant reduction of collisions with pedestrians, especially in high pedestrian areas. So things for consideration. We have pedestrian, I'm skipping ahead on these slides, month 13 now, I believe. Pedestrian refuge islands that we have in several different areas. We usually use these in combination with a school crossing guard, or where possible, controlled intersection location. Slide 14, the use of public art to provide that interesting walking experience. The picture on the right is kind of an octopus take on a, and then we have on the left there a traffic control box where we use some interpretive poems and some art to kind of make that ugly infrastructure that's needed in the landscape and make it a little bit more pretty and more interesting to look at when you're walking. Next slide, 15. We've done road diets to improve that pedestrian environment. We've provided mid-block crossings. Generally, it's been signalized block crossings. Our toolbox is a little bit limited through our Ontario Traffic Act, but we're working again towards looking at different alternatives to provide more mid-block crossings that don't require signalization. Slide 16, again, reduce curb radiuses, shorten that walking distance, providing accessible transit stops. These are all good things that we're doing now and trying to continue to do that on an ongoing basis. Slide 17 is an example of a two-way conversion. We went from a one-way street to a two-way street and how did we make that environment better for pedestrians, providing wider sidewalks, better store frontage areas, addition of street trees, better drainage, bike lanes and bike parking, higher visibility street crossings and transit bays. So really changing the functionality of the street and make it a more pedestrian-oriented street than car dominant. A similar example, but kind of changing the way the one-way street is in another area is, you know, providing buffer space for pedestrians. This is on slide 18. Providing instead of three through lanes, two lanes and a preferred bike lane. Again, providing that extra separation of pedestrians in that environment. And the really main function in slide 9 really demonstrated clearly to our council is how are we planning for our right-of-way space and really showing them the above and below ground challenges and to understand that sometimes it's not just a matter of doing some things because we have to recognize that there's a whole other world beneath the surface that we need to contend with. So in order to do some changes that they may request of us sometimes is we're met with some significant challenges. So when we're planning for these right-of-way spaces up front is making sure, again, as George stated, that paradigm shift, just thinking from the outside in rather than the inside out, and providing for that adequate pedestrian space ahead of time so we're not left with the remainders and then met with challenges that are resulting from that. The other concept that we wanted to get through to council on slide 20 is the difference between sidewalk and clear zone space and really giving them some examples. You know, the clear zone is within the sidewalk space. It's not not just the sidewalk space, because we get, again, when you're looking at that right-of-way space planning, we have those obstructions that when we don't plan for them, we're stuck with utility poles, light standards, and whatnot in the middle of a sidewalk that presents challenges, certainly when you have accessibility challenges, you're in wheelchairs, strollers, walkers, and whatnot, and then this is kind of a suburban area, but when you get into a more urban area and you have those higher densities, you certainly have more challenges and more conflicts that's included in that. And then this is a good example where we do provide more space for pedestrians on slide 21, where we have a wider, unobstructed, clear path to that doesn't have any obstructions for pedestrians who might have some mobility challenges. Again, is providing that concept of what goes into that planning of pedestrian space within the right-of-way zone. Slides 22 then is a commercial example of, you know, the frontage zone, a pedestrian clear zone, utility and furniture zones, and we have a curb zone, and then the street area as well. So even with this example that's in this, it's still a challenge. It's pretty tight, but we wanted to really illustrate to council that this is a business improvement area district, and these are kind of the challenges that's faced when we want to provide quality space and want more people on the street to be shopping. And then the next slide, 23, is the residential side of that thing, and this is more of a newly built suburban pedestrian area where there's a quality of space that's provided versus an area that was probably developed back in the 50s and 60s that are more curb-faced sidewalks of varying slopes and more. The sidewalk design is accommodating the driveway as opposed to accommodating pedestrians, so trying to change that mindset as well. And this is a better example in a newer development. And again, on slide 24, is part of the recommendations to our council was the need for the space and to provide adequate space, certainly in areas where there is high pedestrian generators and through our different road classifications. The next slide, slide 25, is again recommendations and future initiatives. We recognize that there is an investment that's required to accommodate implementation. Again, it's providing a 2 to 7% per project cost for overall road reconstructions or rehabilitations. And then but the benefit again is increasing the pedestrian network connections and continuity. On slide 26, we have certainly the health benefits that we all know and love. Same thing on slide 27, the social benefits. Slide 28, environmental benefits. And again, slide 29, the economic benefits. So there is a return on investment related to the study. We want to make Hamilton the best place to raise a child and to live. Probably similar strategic initiative in many municipalities. And how do we increase that marketability of the city and attract and retain new residents and businesses? We found that walkability is one of those leading factors that go into that. So again, the other benefit is the more we routinely accommodate pedestrians in our day-to-day activities and designs, we reduce the need to do some retrofit for traffic calming, and obviously the individual benefits of their transportation costs, which we hope will go back into our economy if they're not spending money for newer vehicles or additional trips related with vehicles. Slide 30, we have a cost recovery mechanism. We update our development charges calculations every 5 years, and we knew that we have capacity to increase those charges through our roads and walk service levels. And through our pedestrian mobility plan, we recognize that there is certainly a need to increase our service levels within certain areas of the city that's related to growth. The two strategic policies that we presented along with this plan in future initiatives was our traffic calming and management program policy update and pedestrian signal program, which were some key items that came up throughout the study process, but were kind of more detailed, specific policies as opposed to a strategic policy that the pedestrian mobility plan was. So we were able to accommodate some of the concerns of our resident base as well as counselors of trying to make those policies more flexible to encourage walking in the city. And we have a future wayfinding strategy to focus on pedestrian wayfinding, winter control policies, which are an annual debate at council. We have some certain areas of the city that pay extra for winter maintenance and we rely on bylaw for maintenance of other sidewalks. So it's basically left up for residents to their sidewalks. So those are annual decision points that council will have to make on the quality and level of service of our winter control policies, but something that always comes up. And our next stage really is our transportation master plan, and including complete streets policy and integrating the pedestrian mobility plan into a more specific complete streets policy and strategy to supplement the pedestrian mobility plan. And as well, you know, our city comprehensive development guideline, we want to embed into that guideline. Actually, I should correct terminology on there. It's not a guideline, it's a standard, which is a big difference between guideline and standard, and incorporating that toolbox into that standard. And that's the end of my presentation.
Steve and George, thank you very much. There's a lot of meat there to discuss. I know myself, I have several questions I'd like to ask. Maybe I'll just start with a really brief one and then let other people pipe up with their questions. I guess just the policy, the overall, and I would just like to say, I actually live in Hamilton, and I've seen a huge improvement in the roads over the last 5 years. So thank you very much to you in particular, Steve. But just how long did it actually take to develop the pedestrian mobility plan, and who were some of the major partners that worked with you on it?
Well, it was a long time coming. I think one of the key folks at the table was our public health section. And over the last 4 or 5 years, public health and public works has really developed a great working relationship. I know that there was a Canada Walks walking master class that was conducted, and that really set the table to introduce the International Charter for Walking to Council, which they had endorsed. And that International Charter of Walking had, I believe, 8 principles that we used specifically as our vision for this pedestrian mobility plan. So we tried to keep the legacy of all the initiatives that have been occurring over the last 4 or 5 years consistent and together in a working document that will really have some meat and then have some differences on the ground.
Excellent. Well, I have other questions, but I'd like to give other people a chance. So who would like to go first? Maybe while people are thinking, one of the things I'd like to ask is with the policy, George pointed out that there were a number of different options to be considered. So I'm assuming with the policy that when a street, it comes time to tear up a street and kind of repave it or something, I take it that's the moment where you look at the policy, the different options. And I'm wondering if you guys could just explain a little bit more about the process when that happens and who makes the decision and who decides on which treatment you will go with for a particular street.
Well, that's kind of the learning process that we're going to go through next. Ed recently just adopted this plan. But what was envisioned is an iterative process. So to be transparent in our decision making is having that checklist available to go through when we do our capital planning each year. As we're budgeting for these items, there has to be a design process. Also, when we're planning for new subdivisions or new roads as part of our environmental assessment processes, this checklist can be utilized on several different occasions. So it's really used as a starting point, but then a refinement tool to understand that issues might occur that was not thought of in the planning stage, but when we get to the design stage, we can still use this tool to further mitigate what can be used. The other beauty of the tool is we're not saying there's one silver bullet solution. It's really coming up with a handful of solutions that we can apply. So it could be one solution, it could be 4 or 5 solutions together, but there's flexibility in it, which provides flexibility in the decision making as opposed to being left with one particular decision that has to go through. So it's really iterative and flexible to be applied in each and every decision making point that we have in our processes.
Thank you. Anybody else have questions?
Hello. Hi. This is Alexandra from the Montreal Urban Ecology Center. I had a question on that same graph and checklist when you do new works. And also, you mentioned that in the future you'd like to accommodate the concerns of the citizens. I was just wondering what kind of methods do you use to include the public stakeholders, like the citizens, in your decision-making process?
Well, currently we have several subcommittees to council. One of the recommendations that George and our consultants had was to have a pedestrian mobility advisory committee. We've kind of tweaked that a little bit to call it just a mobility advisory committee when we presented to council. And part of that, I guess, terms of reference that still needs to be created, we have a few months to still think about that, but perhaps embedding as part of that committee's responsibility is review and comment on specific plans and designs as they come forward. So that still has to be refined, but that's still the opportunity that we had envisioned for the public to be involved, as well as, you know, any of our major projects that need to be done, any master plans or secondary plans or larger road design projects, there is a public consultation process. So as part of that process, there's always people who are engaged and can participate by providing their comments that way as well.
Thank you.
Hi. Do we have time for another question?
Time for one more.
Okay, I had this is Olivier from the NCCHPP, and I saw as one of your tools when you're dealing with constrained right-of-way in order to accommodate all users, you're considering narrowing the lane width for vehicle travel. I was wondering to what minimum standard are you willing to go depending on the street types and the speed limit? Are you considering to go as low as 3 meters per lane or 3.3, 3.5?
That will vary from street to street and what the issues are. Certainly, we currently have streets that are 3 meters wide, we wouldn't go less than that. However, some of our new designs are 3.75 meters, and that might present a challenge and it's kind of contradictory than what we're trying to achieve. So certainly in constrained areas, that 3 to 3.5 meter range would be considered, and it would all depend on the detail and the context of the street and what we're trying to achieve and what width we would select.
I think we're going to cut things off there because we're running out of time once again. But George, thank you very much. Excellent presentations, really useful information, and wonderful work for the City of Hamilton. Thank you very much. I'm going to try muting the lines again to see if I can get Tanya on the phone while it's muted. And then I will introduce Tanya, and we'll turn things over to her. So here we go with trying the muting process.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Tanya, are you there?
I'm here, if you can hear me.
Okay, because George and Steve, we couldn't hear them when I muted it. So I'm just going to introduce you, Tanya, and then I'll turn things over to you, okay?
Okay.
If you pull up your PowerPoint for Tanya. Tanya's with BC Transit. She's been there for over 18 years. She has worked with communities of all sizes across BC to help shape their sustainable transportation networks and to provide access to all the best things a healthy life has to offer. As manager of operational planning, she and her group of 9 planning staff are responsible for all the short-term service implementations and long-term planning for 130 communities that are served by BC Transit outside of Metro Vancouver. And so we have asked Tanya to handle many different topics, but one of them was to try to address some of the interests that were expressed by Healthy Canada by Design members back in July, that they wanted to hear a little bit about how one could provide transit service to rural and remote communities. And the other one that people wanted to hear about was something about the link between active transportation and and thirdly, the link between planning and public transit. So Tanya is actually going to try and take all of that on. So Tanya, I'll pass it over to you.
Great. Thanks so much. And one thing I didn't add in my bio is that I have a mom who's a nurse and a sister who's an RN and a health practitioner. And so I come by the healthy side or an awareness on that side family-wise, too. So it's an interesting topic to be here today and speaking with all of you guys. So if I move on to my second slide there, what I wanted to do was, for the first part of my presentation, is talk a little bit about BC Transit, and because we operate on a different model than most other transit agencies across the country, so give a little bit of an overview in terms of who we are and our model and the types of services that we offer. And then what I wanted to talk about was explore the different links between health and transportation on, I guess, speaking to some of the subject areas that Kim mentioned. So how are we working in terms of linking to active transportation? What are some of the planning techniques that we're using to help shape healthy communities? And then also because part of transit is key in terms of linking to health, and that can be seen in a lot of different ways. So one is just, you know, getting people to their closest health facilities, hospitals and clinics. But the other part of it is just making sure that people have access to everything in life that is a component of health. If we move to the next slide. So who is BC Transit? So we are a provincial authority. We're called a Crown Corporation, but in the province of BC, we're responsible for planning, funding, and operating all transit in the province outside of Metro Vancouver. So there's a map there, a lot of different communities, a lot of different regions. So we carry 51 million passengers each year. We've got over 1,000 buses. We serve 1.5 million BC residents, so that's the population we serve. And all in all, it comes to 130 communities in 81 transit systems across the province. And we don't do this alone. I'll talk a little bit more about our model in a second, but everything we do is through partnership. So all of our transit systems are a partnership with local governments, as well as with operating companies that we work with to operate all of our services. If we move on to slide four, our model, like I said, is a partnership model, and the different members of our model do different things. So in each transit system, typically there's three partners. So there's ourselves, so BC Transit. We provide a portion of the funding. We administer the contracts for the transit system. We provide professional services like planning, marketing, financial services, fleet management. We also audit the services, make sure they're running. We work with a local government, and so the local government could be a regional district, or it could be a municipality, a city or a village, and they provide the other portion of funding, so they provide the local funding. They provide the ultimate approval of fares and service levels, so we work with them, but in a lot of ways for them, because ultimately if I do a plan, it's a city council that then approves whatever we're suggesting in terms of increasing their service levels or their changing their routes around. They set the system and ridership objectives, so each community gets to say who they want to serve and where they see the priorities are in terms of providing service to their community and their citizens. And then they also get to keep the fare. So they, when passenger fares come in or other forms of revenue, that helps offset the portion of their funding. And I'll talk to funding a little bit more in a second. The third party in our partnership is a local operating company. So they're the people that, while we provide the buses, they actually hire the drivers, hire the mechanics, operate the system, fix the buses, keep everything going. In some cases, those are for-profit companies. In other cases, they're non-profits. So in some of our more rural areas, the folks who are operating our bus system are actually the community services agencies in those areas. And so there's a lot of neat dovetailing of benefits that happens because you've got, the dispatcher for the transit system may also be, coordinating Best Babies programs or other programs that they have going on there. And then some of our operating companies in a few cases are also municipalities. So that's kind of an overview of our partnership model. If you move to the next slide, which is slide five, that kind of provides a little bit of an overview of our services. We have, through legislation, the province of BC funds services, all of our services. So again, that's the BC Transit Services outside of Metro Vancouver. Metro Vancouver is handled by TransLink. So at one end of the spectrum, you have conventional transit, which you'll see on the right. That's a snapshot of the Whistler transit system. So conventional transit is what we typically think of it for a transit system, so fixed routes and schedules, usually more urban settings. There can be a range of vehicle types. We have double-deckers, 40-foot buses, slightly smaller buses for that type of service. And in that case, the province of BC pays for 47% of the transit costs, and then with the remaining 53% covered by the local government. And again, they get to keep the passenger fares to offset that amount. Typically, it winds up being something in the order of about 30-30, a third in terms of provincial funding, local funding, and then passenger funding. On the other end of the spectrum is custom transit or Handy Dart. Well, we call it Handy Dart. And so that's door-to-door services for people with disabilities sufficiently severe that they can't take the conventional transit. In some cases, that's people who have disabilities that are with them all the time. In other cases, it's conditional situations such as night blindness or other disabilities that might come and go, and they would be using Handy Dart because they can't take conventional transit at that time. So we also use taxis to help offer that type of service as well. So that's door-to-door service for those people who can't take the bus. And in that case, through legislation, the province of BC, through us, funds transit at 67%, so two-thirds of the cost for that, with then the remaining third, again, by the local government offset by passenger fares. And then the third category that we have, and you'll see there, is paratransit, and that's a shot of what transit looks like in Ganges on Salt Spring Island. And in that case, paratransit we use as a catch-all term for everything, including those two ends of the spectrum and in between. So for small towns or rural communities, we are doing what we need to do to get people to where they need to go. And that can be a mix of service styles. It can be a mix of vehicles. Some places will have a Handy Dart bus that will provide scheduled service in the morning to get kids to school, and then it will be providing custom Handy Dart service in the middle of the day, as well as a few other different models to provide service. And I'll talk about that. In that case, paratransit funding is weighted depending on which end of the spectrum it falls. So if you move on to slide number six, so that was an overview of our service types. We have in our strategic plan, we did a strategic plan a couple years ago, and there were a number of things that we wanted to work on. And one of those things that we really wanted to strengthen was that one I've highlighted there, number two, which is support and shape livable communities. And so we wanted to encourage transit-supportive community planning and development that makes it easy to get around by walking, cycling, and transit. And the reason why that's key, as this whole day is about, is that if you build communities right, then they are walkable and transit is as effective as it could be. However, if you don't pay attention to those and then kind of transit bats last in terms of we're presented with a road network or a community that is going to be very inefficient to serve with transit, we have no control. We bring supply, but we have no control over that demand side. So if you go to slide seven, these were some of the areas then under that support and shape livable communities that we've been trying to focus on. One is increasing our integration with other kinds of sustainable travel, such as pedestrian walking and cycling, as well as regional connections. We want to look at different ways for influencing land use development patterns, and we also wanted to look at different ways to identify and establish priority corridors for transit, so that we could work with our local governments on ways that we could improve just road conditions to make transit faster. So if you move to the next slide, which is integrating active transportation on slide eight. So how are we doing that? Some of the ways that we are looking to integrate active transportation is that all of our buses are accessible. Most that are in any sort of scheduled service now are all low floor. And we're slowly moving to low-floor Handy Dart buses as well. All of our buses in scheduled service or paratransit service have bike racks on them. When we're building our parking lots and our exchanges and even our garages, we're making sure that they've got bike racks as well as cycling facilities. In the case of garages, for the transit staff will be working there. We also have been exploring partnerships with walking and cycling groups in different ways. There was a past program here in Victoria that we've been working with the Bike to Work Society here to actually be kind of our ambassadors and emissaries for a corresponding transit pass program. they're going out and meeting with folks, they're kind of talking not only about cycling but transit too. And then, of course, when we're doing planning work, we want to ensure that there are members from the cycling community and from walking groups that are part of the stakeholders that are participating that are part of our workshop, and that when we're developing plans in collaboration with communities that we are taking into account cycling and pedestrian plans and pathways. If you go to slide 9, how are we trying to help shape the communities? One of the, or two of the main tools that we're using are the types of plans that we're creating ourselves. So we've always done long-range plans here, but there's a much stronger land use component that's now part of it in terms of looking at the official community plans for a community and putting language in our transit plans and then going back to that community and their official community plan, which governs what their city looks like, to say, here's where the highest order transit is going to be. Please enshrine this in your OCP and do development differently along that corridor. So transit future plans are for the larger communities, service reviews for the smaller ones, but those look at the long term and try and identify those corridors. We also have our transit planners who participate as much as possible in terms of local planning efforts, so regional growth strategies, official community plans, transportation plans, to make sure that transit is a component of their planning as well. And then we also have a program here called Development Referrals, where we request that municipalities can send us development information as they come in and are moving forward, and then we provide information to them saying that, yes, we support this. Yes, this is on a transit corridor, so if you can, please ask for a bus shelter while you're at it, or improve this pedestrian connectivity to make it a much more walkable place and therefore more attractive to get to transit. Or in some cases, look, you're putting a high-density development or even, at the worst case, a hospital in the middle of nowhere. Please do not do this. So we're looking at that as a way to influence. If we go to slide 10, talking a little bit more about transit future plans, and as I mentioned, I've highlighted there, one of the key elements of a transit future plan, other than kind of looking long-term in terms of future ridership and what the service levels themselves, how they might evolve, is identifying what the key transit corridors might be so that we can invest in transit priority and high-quality pedestrian cycling connections along those corridors. And so if you move to slide 11, that is actually a hot-off-the-press example of some maps out of the Prince George Transit Future Plan, which will be going to their council later this month. And what it shows you, if you look on the left, that shows the Prince George transit map as it looks today, a little bit like spaghetti on a plate, all those lovely routes there. But if you look on the right, that kind of shows you where we're going to. So where we've got, what we're trying to do is think in terms of layers. So the red and the blue there are the rapid lines and frequent lines, and they're the highest order transit. And they're the ones that are going to be key to have those improvements made on in terms of clustering high-density residential and destinations there, and also in terms of putting in transit priority measures as road projects go forward. So in terms of good design and corridors, and I'm just mindful of time, but I'll go through these a little bit. I did want to, having this lovely audience here, did want to kind of touch on some of the basics, and it's always useful to just have in the back of your head, and I always feel the more people who know this and can advocate for walkable design and good transit design, the better. So in general, and a lot of these images, I'll just note that they come from TransLink's transit-oriented communities resources, and I've put the links on the bottom of these slides, and that's a lovely set of tools. So I encourage you to go check out their pages. They've got a short form as well as longer-term pieces to kind of dig into this stuff. But again, wherever we can, we want to line up destinations along a corridor. And so if you go to the next slide, which my page numbers have gone away there, but basically it's the one with the aerial photo. It says good design corridors, and it shows a transit corridor superimposed onto an image. And that's what we want our communities to look like. So if we are building a health facility or hospital, we don't want to put it in one of those green areas. In a perfect world, we'll take the hit on capital costs, but put it where it should be, which is somewhere in the middle, somewhere where the transit can actually get to it or is already there. If I move to the next slide where it says good design, walkable, mixed use, again, you know, kind of like following on the work from Hamilton, if we can, when we develop, we want stuff close to the sidewalks, not far away, not having to have people portage over lagoons of parking. That's how we get people walking and connecting to transit. We want to look at, next slide is good design, street as living room. So in this case, again, the whole idea of moving our, where we can, our facilities, our front doors to the street closer to transit rather than putting the parking lots out front. And if you move to the next slide where it says good design, street as living room, and there's some photos there, one of which, again, is the Ganges Transit Exchange. The others I've drawn from projectforpublicspaces.org, and I've put the link there. So again, there's some other, if just another helpful resource at pps.org in terms of transit-oriented design and in terms of good street, I guess, architecture. How do you create places, not just roads and sidewalks? So if we move forward now, and I'm sorry, I don't know what happened here on my page numbers. My next one that I'm on is called Providing Access, Small and Rural Towns. So that was some of the theory behind what we're doing. What I'd also wanted to speak to then is some of the examples that we're doing in terms of how we are providing service in smaller towns and more rural areas. So one thing that we have is a health connections program. This is predominantly in support of, or with the support of the Interior Health Authority, but we also have a transit system that's also co-funded by the Northern Health Authority. In that case, that's the Skeena Regional System connecting Kitimat and Terrace, BC, so somewhat northern communities. So in all of these cases, it's smaller towns, rural towns, First Nations communities that are ways away from a central area where the health authority centralized services and then kind of went, hey, wait a second, if we're centralizing service, we also need to figure out how we're going to get people to those services. One example is actually from Skeena Regional where if you're having so Terrace and Kitimat are about 45 minutes apart. If you're having a baby, let's hope that you can hold it in, but you're going to have it in Terrace, no matter where you live in that region. If you have something going on that's to do with bones or elder care, it's probably happening in Kitimat. So they're having people go back and forth between those in terms of the different types of care that they have. And so they partnered with us on that transit system. Similarly, in the interior, you can see there's an example schedule there for the Thompson-Nicola Regional District. So that's providing service to Kamloops. And if you go to the next slide where it says providing access, small and rural towns, health connections, you can see a map of some of the distances that buses are traveling. By no means is this everyday hourly service. This is, you know, 1, 2, 3 day a week, taking people all the way in, taking them back. But the nice thing by having partnered with the health authorities is they have offset the costs on transit, and they've made the investment there, recognizing that they're saving by centralizing health costs. They're providing the transportation for those who need it. On our side, though, is they've understood that they could have invested on their own and just be serving health people traveling for health reasons, but by partnering with us and the local municipalities, we now have service that's serving a wide variety of needs, not just health needs. So shopping, school, social are all being helped by this service. If we go to the next slide, which says providing access to small and rural towns, the flex routing, the Hazeltons Regional Transit. So this is an example of the Hazeltons Transit System. You can see it there. So it serves 6 First Nations communities and 3 other communities. Those communities are all partners in funding of the transit system with the regional district. And in this case, you know, in the Hazletons, their closest grocery store is now in Smithers, which is 40 minutes away. Their closest rec center is also there, too. So in terms of providing access to the local hospital, which is near where the village of Hazleton is shown for that area, or for their larger hospital, which would be into Smithers, or the other aspects of health that we've talked about, you know, groceries, social, recreational, larger physiotherapy appointments, they're using the Hazleton system. And in this case, it's a smaller bus. It has the ability to, it has routes, but it has the ability to go off route to pick up people with a disability, so if they can't walk to the bus route, and also has a little bit of time in the schedule that the driver can offer if it's a parent with small kids or someone's coming home with a lot of bags of groceries, they can also drop them off at their door. So it's been a really helpful service in an area where there is a lot of need and not a lot of access to private automobiles. If we go to the next slide, which is providing access to small rural towns, and this time the Comox Valley Regional Transit System. In this case, what we had were some more rural areas, more kind of agricultural land where people were spread out. However, the elected official for the area still wanted to provide some level of transit service. So to provide conventional service here would never have worked. Handy Dart service, even that would have been a hard one because it would have taken the Handy Dart bus so far away from the core part of the system. And so in this case, what we did is we implemented something we call trip windows. So for these areas, there are three trip windows each weekday, 8 to 9, 11 to 12, 4 to 5. So it takes into account people who might be commuting, but also people who might want a shorter morning or afternoon period to go to an appointment or access shopping, recreational. And you can call in. You may have a disability or you could not. It's for anyone. And you call in, and if there's someone who calls in, then the bus is dispatched and goes and picks up that person, or if there's a number of people, just goes to where they are and then brings you back to the core part of the community. And if no one calls in, then that time just goes into the Handy Dart system for a same-day request. So it's a very efficient way of providing service to more rural areas and grouping those people together and not having buses run around when they're not needed. And then finally, my last example in terms of providing access to small and rural towns. This one isn't really... well, I guess in the context of some places it would be small town. So this is Mission, the district of Mission, just up the Fraser Valley from a little bit from Vancouver. And in this case, we had our conventional bus in Mission, and it's not showing here, but basically as you go north on the map, there is a steep hill, and I'm talking BC steep hill. And all of the seniors' housing is up that hill, whereas downtown where the services are is down the hill. And we kept getting requests from different seniors' residences to have our big bus system, our conventional bus system, deviate more and more trips to come pick them up. There is a need there. And so we looked at that need, and so we thought, well, let's deal with this a little bit differently. And so what we did is onto the existing conventional system and Handy Dart system, we layered something that we call the Shopper Shuttle. At the time we came up with that, that little graphic there for it. But basically what it did is it created a bi-directional or a loop, a large loop that hit the hospital, the shopping malls, a number of the larger seniors' residences. And what it does is it allows, means that our conventional buses can stay where they need to be to provide direct service for people. It means that that people who are living in the seniors' residences who want to go to a hair appointment or go get their groceries or things that aren't like a medical trip that is scheduled aren't using Handy Dart services, they can hop on this one. And because it's operated by a small bus, it has the time and the flexibility to deviate off route to pick them up or drop them closer to the Safeway instead of dumping them at the stop at the low-heat highway. And the other piece of this is it's become a social aspect. So in the picture there, you can see Mrs. McLaren and Mrs. Jacobson, who are a key part of developing the service. And basically, it got to the point where I would just need to call them up and just say, okay, how's it going? And then say, well, we want this trip instead of this trip. Can we trade this in? Or we want to go here. And so that's why I've got on-road participatory democracy, because it wound up not being just transit service and access to health and the needs of life, but also a community. They would have birthday cakes for their bus driver. They would see each other. So it wound up being a really neat experiment. And then last slide is just my thank you and my contact details. If you have, certainly there's a little bit of time left for questions, but if you have questions about our model or the types of services, feel free to give me a call. Thanks very much.
Tanya, thank you so much. That was excellent. I'm just going to hit *5 to open the lines.
The conference is now in talk mode.
And Tanya, I would just like to say, I have to say, I'm so impressed. Living here in Ontario, it's very, very hard to get anywhere without a car, like from between communities sometimes. I'm just kind of curious if you've ever, there's ever been kind of a study of all the health and kind of safety and co-benefits associated with the service that you provide.
Every once in a while, because we are provincially funded, the province wants to get a sense of whether their dollars are worth or not. I'm not aware of other studies other than every once in a while the government will have a study done on BC Transit, and we'll find out. So we carry, on average, more people per hour of service at a lower cost per ride than comparable transit systems across the country. And I think a large part of it is just that economy of scale that we have. I guess I didn't really talk about that. We've got one, by having everything under one umbrella organization in the past, what it allows us to do is we have one fuel contract for the province. When we go to buy a bus, we don't just do, you know, orders of one or two, which is a municipality elsewhere, but we buy in the tens or hundreds. So, yeah, it's been good. And other than those provincial studies, like I said, I'm not aware of others that have kind of looked at that.
Thank you. And I just want to remind everybody that all the lines are open, so just careful of your background noise. So do people have questions for Tanya?
This is Helena. I do. One thing that I have seen with the transit-oriented resources is that and plans is that some agencies have not been sort of differentiating what kind of road the community is fronting onto. So the whole concept that the urban design should front, that the frontage should be right on the street and the parking should be behind. Sometimes what's been happening is that we then end up with something that is essentially a trucking route, and yes, it may eventually have a bus too, but it is really quite high volume traffic, and even if not high volume, is almost entirely trucks, which is not a great place to have people fronting onto because of exposures to injuries, and exposure to noise, exposure to air pollution. How are you guys taking that into consideration, because in those circumstances, actually fronting onto perhaps a square away from the street actually might be a better option.
Right. So in some of those cases, it's working with municipalities, right? Because they, in our case, they ultimately make the call in terms of what the land use and the development looks like in the community. And you're right, there are a couple of places, more and more places are looking at ways that they can either take the truck route and look at ways of traffic calming it or changing the nature of that road. So Abbotsford would be an example of that. Others, such as in the Kelowna area, so if this is an area of interest, we've been working with the city of Kelowna in Rutland, and that's Rutland. And they've actually taken Highway 33 is the road through Rutland, but what they've done is they did a study plans that have now created a high street that intersects that, and that's where they're looking at reorienting their their community that they're going there. And then at the focal point of that in that new high street is the transit experience. So we're working with them on that and a piece of that. I'm not sure. You're right. It's a really tough call. It's kind of like what the folks from Hamilton were talking about, right? Like when you've got a heritage space and how the shift gets.
So, but what I'm hearing from you is that you actually do consider what kind of road, and that does change, because I really liked what you said about the development referrals. I very much liked what you had to say about that. So when you are talking about those things, you do take into consideration the exposure to air pollution, injuries, and all those other pieces as well.
Yeah, and also the other thing we take into account, too, is community context. So I didn't really get into this, but one of the big things that we've been trying to talk about with our municipalities is that density has many faces. So mobile homes, court in some of our communities, that's density, you know, that's for secondary suites, that's another element of density. So there's a lot of different, not everywhere is going to look like Falls Creek in Vancouver with humongous high towers. That's not necessarily density, but there are opportunities to keep moving along that spectrum in even our tiniest town.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for Tonya?
Well, hi, it's Richard here. I was curious about whether or not you have any kind of performance or accountability mechanisms with that 47% funding. Like you mentioned how you have or want an influence in terms of having transit-friendly development in the communities. Do you have any kind of connection between, encouraging with a bit of a stick communities to develop in a more transit-friendly way that would be contingent on receiving their funding or not?
Yeah, so that's, you're exactly right. So in our legislation, it says that we will speak to OCPs and regional growth strategies, but there's the stick, the
mm-hmm.
We do in our transit future plans. We do have service design standards and then performance guidelines in terms of evaluating our investments and how we're going to continue to monitor our communities. When we're doing a feasibility study for a new area, we're looking at a number of different metrics to see whether it's feasible to provide service. We're looking at cost per ride. We're looking at rides per hour, and we have some thresholds that we use in terms of what we call the GHG minimum to make sure that, you know, we're not putting more GHG into the air by running a bus than if people were driving. And in some cases, for pretty tiny towns, you need to be aware of that. And then finally, when we're evaluating communities who are requesting expansion, we are looking to see a little bit in terms of where is this going? What is the ride per hour going to be coming from this? And we have done some sense of looking at ridership would be places that are making to densify and do more transit friendly development versus coverage areas where or coverage extensions where it's more just in terms of providing access. And if you need both, request
mm-hmm.
for both.
Tonya, can I just ask, are you on a speakerphone? Because you're echoing a little bit.
Okay, and I can't change it at this point because it's the only.
Okay, I just, you know what? It's just a few minutes to 3. I think we have time for one last question, but that's it. Anybody have one pressing question they want to put to Tonya? I think we're going to call it quits. Thank you very much, Tonya. That was really excellent and very inspiring for those of us who don't have a provincial transit system like you do in BC. But thank you very much for participating today. And thank you to everybody who was on the line and who asked questions and participated today. Thank you very much to everybody.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.